whole history of the area is one of intrigue, of murder, and meddling by the Western imperialist powers.
It was you, Mr. Bush, who supported Iraq every year with $4.5 billion worth of foreign credits used to buy arms. It was you who were warned on February 24th by King Hussein and by President Hosni Mubarak of Egypt that Saddam was threatening reprisals on Kuwait. Your answer was to send your friend Robert Dole on April 12th to assure Saddam of your support and your friendship.
The Free Kuwaiti movement had pressured the Sheikh to establish a legislative council to have some form of democracy there. And the first meeting of this legislative council, this was in 1938, it passed a unanimous resolution demanding that Kuwait be reverted to Iraq. These are the Kuwaitis themselves. Well, the Britain got alarmed at all this, and so they told the Sheikh to, they forced him to dissolve the legislative council and hunt down, detain, and execute all the members.
At this meeting, the U.S. ambassador said to Saddam Hussein, "I have a direct instruction from the Secretary of State to emphasize to you that the United States has, quote-unquote, no opinion on your border disputes with Kuwait."
Especially if Santa Fe drilling was going at an angle. So you could be on your territory, but sucking the oil out of somebody else's territory. And this is what the Kuwaitis did. They drilled the oil wells on their land, and then they were sucking the oil out of the Iraqi side of this huge oil field.
The American public was lied to continuously during George Bush's war against Iraq. But we'll try to clarify some of the issues involved in the war right now on Alternative Views. Propagandization of the American people was so intense and so continuous during the Iraq War that we're going to try to clarify some of the three main issues which were either ignored or severely distorted by the regular media and the government during this period. We're going to go back and take a look at various sections of previous Alternative Views programs and some new information, providing you some data on the history of Iraq and Kuwait, which was completely ignored by the regular media. Secondly, the problems which Iraq had with Kuwait before the war started. Just what these problems were and why they were not resolved peaceably is an issue which we'll get into. And finally, the Machiavellian diplomacy of the United States, which appears, on hindsight, to have been very deliberate and very cunning in order to draw Iraq into this war. We have an article by Ralph Schoenman called Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed. It's put out by Veritas Press. And it has the most comprehensive history of the relationship between Kuwait and Iraq that I've ever seen. And Ralph Schoenman says that little is known of the fact that there has been a popular struggle for decades to return the area of Kuwait to Iraq, which it was part of for many, many years. Now, this ferment has been not only been in Iraq, but also in Kuwait itself. Well, Schoenman goes back and gives the history of the area. He talks about Mesopotamia,
which was the general large area in the Near East before it was broken up by the imperial powers after World War I.
For several centuries, Kuwait had been the southern part of the Basra province of the Ottoman Empire under the Turks.
The Ottoman Empire, which ruled that entire region really from the Maghreb to the Mashrek, for centuries.
From northwestern.
From North Africa,
right.
Across to the Gulf region.
And even the areas, the coastal areas of the Arabian Peninsula at one time, too.
At one time.
But the whole history of the area is one of intrigue, of murder, and meddling by the Western imperialist powers. British first tried to detach the area now known as Kuwait from the Ottoman rule. And they did this by trying to get the brothers, two brothers of the Sheikh, who was appointed by the Ottomans, to agree to take over and let the British then run the area. Well, the two brothers refused, two brothers of the Sheikh, Mubarak, they refused, and so the British had Mubarak murder his two brothers. And then they got Mubarak to agree that that Kuwait would be detached from the Ottoman Empire and be part of the British Empire. Well, the Ottoman leaned a little bit on Sheikh Mubarak, and Mubarak decided that he would renounce that accord with the British.
The Ottoman Empire met its demise after World War I, when a lot of promises that Britain and the other Allied powers had made to the Arabs in order to secure their assistance during the war were not kept. And the Allied powers divided up the Middle East among themselves and their associates, so that Lebanon, what we now know as Lebanon, Syria, and these two countries went under French control. Iraq, the entire Gulf area, Jordan, and Egypt went under British control. That was after World War I.
Oil had already been discovered in Iran and Iraq. So oil is central to this thing all the way back to the beginning. The boundaries that are today under dispute were actually first drawn up by a British High Commissioner of Iraq in 1922. Kuwait wasn't even present. But one of the things that he did do that's important for us to know today was he put that Kuwait in there to make Iraq a landlocked nation.
Kuwait was severed from Basra. The Iraqis did not accept it. The British in 1922 drew the first lines in the sand, delineating boundaries for the first time in history between Jordan, Iraq, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. These lines, drawn by Sir Percy Cox in 1922, he was the British High Commissioner in Baghdad, these lines were drawn deliberately to deprive Iraq of a viable seaport. The British wanted no competition from Baghdad, which was at that time the cultural and commercial capital of the Gulf region, to their dominance of the Persian Gulf, where they converted no less than 10 sheikhdoms into colonies, including Kuwait.
During this time, there was tremendous opposition to the British taking Kuwait from the area of Iraq. And there was great ferment not only in Iraq, but also in Kuwait to join the two areas back again. And the two areas remained, even up until the 1940s, very close. For instance, the Postal Service was still run by the Iraqis in Kuwait up until the start of World War II. And the curricula in Kuwaiti schools was Iraqi curricula up until after World War II. In Kuwait, there developed a Free Kuwaiti movement. And it was a mass movement within that little country. And they submitted a mass petition to the Iraqi government and to have Kuwait go back to Iraq. Well, the British found out about it, and Meanwhile, the Free Kuwaiti movement had pressured the Sheikh to establish a legislative council to have some form of democracy there. And the first meeting of this legislative council, this was in 1938, it passed a unanimous resolution demanding that Kuwait be reverted to Iraq. These are the Kuwaitis themselves. Well, Britain got alarmed at all this, and so they told the Sheikh they forced him to dissolve the legislative council and to hunt down, detain, and execute all the members. Now, in Iraq, a king was set up named the name of Ghazi, and the British ambassador told him to quit supporting the Free Kuwaiti movement. But Ghazi refused. And in April 1939, he was found dead. People think the British did it. And in his place, an infant, Faisal II, took over. But there was really the power and control was in the hands of a fellow named Nuri S. Said, who was really a British agent. He was a stooge at whatever the British wanted him to do. Now, after World War II, the U.S. Penetrated the area a lot, set up the Baghdad Pact. Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Pakistan, Great Britain participated along with the United States. And, of course, the Iraqi premier, Nuri S. Said, who, by the way, had been an officer in the Ottoman army, he did pretty much whatever the British wanted him to. But with the invasion of Egypt by Britain and France and Israel in 1956, revolutionary fervor hit the area, and it was very difficult for Nuri S. Said to control Iraq. Even though he publicly supported the British and the French, he also asked them that in order to placate Iraqi national sentiment, they should return Kuwait to Iraq. Nuri S. Said said that he should, well, he put it up to a vote of the Baghdad Pact whether to return Kuwait to Iraq. And all the members of the Baghdad Pact, except Great Britain, voted to return Kuwait to Iraq. Well, now, Iraq informed Britain that it was preparing a formal memorandum, well supported by documents and copies of secret undertakings and understandings, which would be published before the world on July 12, 1958, on the necessity of Kuwait's immediate returning to the Union of Iraq and Jordan, instead of being separated. Well, guess what happened? Because of that, there was a revolution which occurred on July 14, 1958, overthrew Nuri S. Sadat. The British were at it again. And the fellow who took over was Karim Qasim. And it was a coup which initially didn't alarm the CIA or Washington because they were really actually behind it. But it was more radical than what the U.S. and the CIA wanted. Qasim continued to alienate both the United States and Britain by demanding the return of Kuwait. And he was particularly incensed when Britain gave Kuwait its independence and in 1961, rather than turning it back over to Iraq.
When Kuwait was given its independence by the British in 1961, the Iraqis massed troops on the border and threatened to take the territory back by force. But Britain rushed military forces to Kuwait and the Iraqis back down. The Iraqis threatened to do the very same thing in 1972 and 1976.
Well, it looked like Qasim had to go. And he did. In February 63, another coup shook Iraq, killing Qasim. And who was in it? Well, the CIA, of course. The CIA actually had an airlift of arms to Iraq to help the coup plotters. And they brought in a fellow who was more pliant to the United States as a replacement. And at that time, they dropped the opposition of Iraq to the independence of Kuwait and Kuwait's entry into the United States. Now, who was a prominent member of this coup? Was none other than Saddam Hussein. But Saddam Hussein was a member of the right-wing faction, not a kind of a centrist faction, if you want to use those terms, as actually took power with the killing of Qasem. But eventually the rightists did take power, and what ensued was a general slaughter of the left. The radicals, the Communist Party members, trade unionists, radicals of every sort, were tortured and killed, with the CIA giving directions, according to this article by Mr. Schoenman. Well, throughout the 70s, the regime of Saddam Hussein attempted to compromise with the Kuwaiti rulers on Iraq, and that they would drop the provision of the return, perhaps, if the Kuwaitis would let them have access to the former islands in the Gulf so that they would have a port there. The foreign minister of Iraq visited Kuwait City in 1972 so that they could work out another problem, which was that Kuwait decided it was getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Kuwait wanted more of the oil fields up there in Iraq, and so it surreptitiously, well, not too surreptitiously, they started expanding their borders by creating border guards and border crossings further to the north into Iraqi territory. And so Iraq was concerned about this and wanted them to stop.
Saddam had a number of very specific complaints against Kuwait that he began voicing really late last spring and very publicly in the course of the summer. One was just that Kuwait for years had been extracting Iraqi oil and selling it. Two, that Kuwait was refusing to sell its oil at a higher price in order to assist the Iraqi economy.
In 1986, the OPEC countries had set $18 per barrel as the bench price for the world petroleum market. But the Kuwaitis and the United Arab Emirates for quite a long time since then had been overproducing, forcing the price down as low as about $13 last June. That price was the best price that industrialized countries and importers like the United States were paying for petroleum at constant dollars for more than 40 years. It was hurting the Iraqi economy because the Iraqis had something like $70 to $80 billion in debt from their war, their eight-year war with Iran during the 1980s. And they were demanding that the Iraqis forgive those loans which had helped finance that war.
There is another claim which Saddam Hussein made, and that's the fact that there is a very significant oil field in Iraq, but a little tip of it goes into Kuwait. Then they hired they actually purchased Santa Fe Drilling Corporation of California for the sum of $2.3 billion, the Kuwaitis did. And the specialty of Santa Fe Drilling was going at an angle. So you could be on your territory, but sucking the oil out of somebody else's territory. And this is what the Kuwaitis did. They drilled the oil wells on their land, and then they were sucking the oil out of the Iraqi side of this huge oil field.
Kuwait was not making any, Kuwait was not granting Iraq any concessions on the debt that it had accrued in the course of the Iraq-Iran war. So Saddam Hussein really felt that Kuwait was out to get him and to get Iraq.
And so Saddam Hussein, the brute that he is, he moved in.
Some people are saying that the U.S. pulled off one of the most brilliant Machiavellian maneuvers in U.S. diplomatic history. Let's take a look at what seems to be the best evidence on what was going on behind the scenes and try to see what really happened.
A lot of the spotlights and some history books and some other events have indicated that maybe the United States really pulled a slick one on this. It seems that there's a lot of evidence, and the Arabs and the Iranians believe that, to start out with, the Iraqis were tricked into attacking Iran. the CIA fed information to the Iraqis that, hey, you can go ahead and attack Iran. They're pushovers. They're weak. They won't fight. The whole edifice will come down. Well, you know what happens. It was a terrible, terrible bloody war with millions of deaths on both sides and left both really reeling.
The CIA, of course, was a very important tool in the Cold War, and certainly it was important in building up Saddam Hussein in Iraq. I suppose most of you have read already that the United States, in its support for Iraq all during that war with Iran, was giving Iraq the best intelligence possible on Iranian troop movements. It was, what I've read is that they were giving them real-time satellite information so that they could confront and defeat the Iranian forces in that war.
And of course, while the United States was helping out Iraq militarily and urging them on, they were also giving clandestine help to the Iranians. So they were trying to keep both sides bled white.
A great deal has been made of the fact that the United States helped arm Iraq and that the United States provided high-tech technologies. In fact, during the year prior to the Iraqi invasion, something like 400 or more licenses were granted for high-tech exports to Iraq. Much less attention has been paid to what seems to have been a complicity between the United States and Iraq to increase oil prices, generally. The United States, according to the London Observer, Bush sent an envoy, an ex-ambassador, and it's not clear who it was, to Hussein in January of 1990, suggesting that he push OPEC to cut back production enough to raise oil prices to $25 a barrel. Hussein got the same advice, apparently, from a U.S. think tank who was hired to make recommendations about Iraqi economic policy, suggesting that $25 a barrel would bring in a lot more money, would help it deal with its debt problems, would help it deal with its reconstruction problems after the Iraq-Iran war, without provoking any massive increase in conservation, without provoking any kind of shift to other energy sources, right? In other words, the price would be higher, but it wouldn't be too high. So apparently the United States and Iraq had agreed with this, and there's also indications that also Iran agreed with this, because they also wanted to rebuild themselves after the war. And then even Saudi Arabia went along with this. And the two holdouts were Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates, who were both pumping more oil than their OPEC quota allowed, and driving down the price of oil. They seemed to be happy with having a new policeman in OPEC. They had never been happy with the way the Saudis managed OPEC, because the Saudis had no military punch. They couldn't threaten anybody or bully anybody. All they could do is threaten to produce more oil. And the last time they did this in a serious fashion, there was a kind of price war within OPEC, was back in 1986, and they drove oil prices so far down that George Bush, then vice president, jumped on a plane and went flying to the Middle East to implore the Saudis to stop pumping oil and to get the price back up, because his Texas oil friends were losing money hand over fist, wellheads were being closed, and the financial sector of the Southwest was going under, because this oil price had fallen so low. So already in 1986, Bush was actively and personally supporting a high oil price.
The U.S. has demonized Saddam Hussein as being an absolute villain, a monster, a torturer and killer of his people.
Which he is.
Which he is. And during that time, the State Department put out a human rights report that detailed some of the atrocities that Saddam Hussein had committed against his people. James Baker, the head of the State Department, a Texas oil man, Bush's bosom buddy, said, hey, we can't publish this report because Iraq and Saddam Hussein are our friends. They're getting oil prices higher for us. We're working closely with them, so we don't want to offend
them. Not only that, but they intervened with Congress to prevent Congress from passing sanctions against the Iraqis for these same reasons. And by that time, it should be noted, Amnesty International and Middle East Watch had accumulated so much evidence of the horrors of the Saddam Hussein regime that shortly after the invasion, they would have put a book out. A book! A whole book detailing this. And this is what the Bush administration was trying to suppress at that point in time, because Bush and the Iraqis were agreed on high oil prices. No, that is not what the war is about. They went to war when Hussein went beyond the lease that he had been given. When he ceased to be merely the cop of OPEC, right? And he tried to become OPEC. By taking over the Kuwaiti oil fields, he would have had oil reserves as big as Saudi Arabia. And he obviously was on his way to establishing his own personal control over the whole area. That's the kind of thing which the United States clearly is not about to accept, not from Iraq, not from Iran, not from Assad in Syria, or anybody else.
So they saw him as a hegemonic threat in the region who was trying to control more resources.
To usurp American influence.
Than they wanted him to...
it's one thing to bully Kuwait into cutting back its oil production so oil prices can be high. It's another thing to be throwing around this gigantic army that he's got, right, and doing what he wants to do independently of Washington.
This discussion that we're now having is put in an interesting context in an article by Craig Hewlett called The Secret U.S. Agenda of the Gulf War that indicates that in April of 1990, there was a White House conference, a meeting of members of the ruling classes of all the European countries, and they put out a task force report on this conference, and it was published by Derek Fitzgerald, the former Prime Minister of Ireland, who wanted people to know what was discussed at this conference. And according to this article, this analysis by Craig Hewlett, who's a former military defense analyst, who is now an independent researcher working in Seattle, Washington, with a group, KC and Associates, that's a group of retired intelligence officers, military people, generals, and some former National Security Administration people, are now criticizing, as John Stockwell did, their former employees, and they have published an analysis of the Gulf War from the context of this report that was published in April of 1990 that said that the Middle East needs to be completely disarmed, that the ballistic missiles, the conventional weapons, the nuclear, the chemical, everything has to be taken out, and that the main threat to stability of the region is Saddam Hussein and his military machine, and it needs to be destroyed completely in order to guarantee the stability of the region. They talked about how this could be done through the UN and through utilizing some sort of UN resolutions to try to demilitarize the Middle East, and they came to the conclusion this is impractical. Only through a war could the military machine of Saddam Hussein be destroyed. And according to Hewlett, this consensus that was built up among the power elites of these European countries would explain why in the United Nations Bush was able to get all of these countries that are usually squabbling right behind him to pass all of these resolutions, that they'd already agreed that Saddam Hussein's military was a menace to the peace, the stability, which means the flow of oil and the control by U.S. and European interests of that region for their own ends, and that therefore he needed to be taken out. Now, what's chilling about this when you think of it in the context of the future is that they concluded that all of these military machines, Syria, Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, that all of these military regimes were a threat and that the military had to be completely eliminated in every one of these regimes.
What about Israel?
They don't mention Israel, which is, of course, the biggest military machine in the region with the most nuclear weapons, chemical, biological. In fact, when they kept saying that Iraq during the Persian Gulf War had the fourth largest military machine in the world, they conveniently left Israel out of this, that has a much larger military machine than Iraq.
It was an authoritative article published by a man called Benjamin in Haaretz, who's a senior political commentator in Israel. It was published around the middle of August of 1990, 2 weeks after the crisis began, in which he put forward the views of the Israeli government. And essentially they are, the regime of Saddam Hussein has to be destroyed. Its military capacity has to be destroyed. Its industrial capacity has to be destroyed. And in effect, the kind of bombing that that only a massive airstrike could accomplish would have the effect of setting back Iraq for roughly two generations. And this was exactly echoed a few days ago in the Washington Post by General Duggan, the Air Force Chief of Staff, you recall, who was fired by Cheney a couple of days later. But the Israeli view has, I think, had a kind of hegemony, has prevailed in planning in Washington, I believe to a fantastic degree, that the only way to deal with this particular crisis, which is a real crisis, is essentially military. And I have a very great fear that the military solution is, in fact, the only solution acceptable both to the Israelis and to the United States at this point, unless some air is, some sun is let in and it opens up. And the Israeli position is, very simply, that any sign of Arab strength, any sign of Arab determination, of capacity for mobilizing, for in fact providing a real deterrence to Israeli superiority, which is assured principally by the United States, has to be hit.
Now, this group you're talking about, was it a secret thing? Because I don't remember seeing about it, reading about it.
No, they've been trying to publicize this. They've been meeting with...
No, I mean the group, the...
This task force. This is the first I've read of this.
And it was at the White House.
It was a conference of the White House in the April of 1990.
And it was the U.S. plus the European.
It was U.S., European, and major players in the geopolitical power game. And they put out a report afterwards that was actually published and that they got hold of. That Derek Fitzgerald, who was a former Prime Minister of Ireland, decided that this should be released. But it indicates, one, why the UN coalition operated as smoothly and quickly as it did, why Bush was able to get all these European countries on board, and that is because there was a consensus that you had to take out these military machines in the Mideast.
Well, this was the point of providing so much help to Iran in its war against Iraq. They were trying to bleed both countries white.
Right, they just told them that they would wipe each other out.
But it didn't work out that way.
It didn't work out that way because the military machine of Saddam Hussein became more and more vast because the U.S. and the European countries sold him such a fantastic amount of military equipment that he was able to build up his machine during the Iran and Iraq war rather than having his military wiped out.
It was you, Mr. Bush, who supported Iraq every year with $4.5 billion worth of farm credits used to buy arms. It was you who were warned on February 24th by King Hussein and by President Hosni Mubarak of Egypt that Saddam was threatening reprisals on Kuwait. Your answer was to send your friend Robert Dole on April 12th to assure Saddam of your support and your friendship. According to transcripts of that meeting, you knew 214 Bell helicopters were sold to Iraq and used for their military. You knew that the 1985 shipment of the rare West Nile fever virus from the U.S. Center for Disease Control ended up in Iraq as part of its biological warfare program. You knew of the gassing of Kurds, and yet you still tried to defeat the sanctions against Iraq passed by Congress on July 27.
In the meantime, on the political front, when Reagan came to power, old Bill Casey saw that he had a rather significant adversary, or at least a very experienced person in the form of ambassador to the United States from Saudi Arabia, a very capable, experienced man. So William Casey managed to maneuver and get rid of this person and got Prince Bandar appointed as ambassador to the United States. Prince Bandar was very inexperienced, but he was a member of the ruling family, so he had direct links to the power structure. And Casey found that he could manipulate this prince and feed him bad information. So this turned out to be part of the equation. National Security Advisor Scowcroft showed some top secret documents, quote unquote, to Prince Bandar showing that Saddam Hussein was going to invade Saudi Arabia. But the documents were actually bogus. A little later, Bandar asked his government in a great panic for U.S. troops to be sent in. And, of course, this is the way the Saudis were brought into it. Trico, trico, right? Well, on the Kuwaiti front, it seems that CIA documents have emerged as a result of the Iraqi invasion, indicating that the Americans were playing a game tricking Kuwait. They were telling Kuwait, hey, go ahead and stand firm on the problems you're having with Iraq. Iraq has these certain demands they're making of you, and they want to negotiate with you, but stand firm. Don't give in to them, because Iraq is in a weakened position, and we're going to back you all the way.
In June and July, there is some circumstantial evidence to indicate that there may very well have been a major central intelligence agency and intelligence support activity undergone by the Pentagon of covert action to remove Saddam Hussein from his position of leadership. The August 19th Washington Post, it says, on August 10th, at the Arab Summit Conference in Cairo, Kuwait's foreign minister, Sabah Ahmad Sabah, confronted Iraq's foreign minister, Tariq Aziz, publicly accusing Iraq of an unprovoked aggression in violation of international law. And Tariq Aziz, the foreign minister from Iraq, pointed to the Kuwaiti foreign minister and said, "You beware. We possess and will reveal to the world the contents of your conversations and documents and communications between the Kuwaiti Foreign Ministry and the United States Central Intelligence Agency, and of your plans to take steps to deal with Saddam Hussein." And the foreign minister of Kuwait fainted dead away.
In April, the Assistant Secretary of State for Middle Eastern Affairs, a man whose name is John Kelly, testified before the U.S. Congress that the United States had no commitment to defend Kuwait. In July, the OPEC oil ministers met in Geneva, that's mid-July, and Iraq was demanding a raise in the oil price and also the elimination of overproduction on the part of Kuwait and the Emirates. Iraq at that time massed 30,000 troops on the Kuwaiti border. Hussein got part of what he wanted. The Emirates and Kuwait agreed to stop overproducing. New quotas were set in order to maintain a new price of $21 per barrel, even though Iraq had asked for $25. In any case, things were not settled, even with that, because Iraq was continuing to demand that Kuwait lease to Iraq two small islands, Boubian and Warba, at the head of the Persian Gulf, which would have provided Iraq with a viable seaport. Kuwait refused. Kuwait also refused to forgive the loans that had been made to finance Iraq's war with Iran. Negotiators met in Saudi Arabia between the two countries on the 1st of August. Kuwait did not compromise, and the next day Saddam Hussein invaded. Well, the United States was not unaware that this was coming by any means. On April 25th, some of you have read this, I'm sure, July 25th, April Glaspie, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, had a meeting, a face-to-face meeting with Saddam Hussein. At that meeting, she said, according to a transcript, apparently the Iraqis recorded the conversation secretly and later made available the transcript, a transcript which, by the way, has not been disputed by the Department of State. At this meeting, the U.S. ambassador said to Saddam Hussein, "I have a direct instruction from the Secretary of State to emphasize to you that the United States has, quote-unquote, no opinion on your border disputes with Kuwait." She also said, "I have an instruction from the President to seek better relations with Iraq." At this time, there were 100,000 Iraqi troops poised on the border. Because after the OPEC conference in Geneva in mid-July, the Iraqis did not withdraw those 30,000 troops. They more than tripled them to something like 100,000. During this time also, in the days following, or the week following, the ambassador's meeting with Hussein up to the invasion, the CIA, according to press reports and according to Senator Boren, who is the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, the CIA was predicting that Iraq would invade Kuwait. And in fact, in the meeting between the U.S. ambassador and Hussein, Hussein himself responded to her, saying, in effect, that he was going to take drastic action against Kuwait if they did not agree to his demands. So it was as clear as crystal, I believe, that Hussein was going to invade Kuwait. But during that week, that crucial week between the ambassador's meeting with Hussein and the invasion, with those 100,000 Iraqi troops on the border, the Bush administration did absolutely nothing. And there were things they could have done. They could have called, for example, an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council. They could have sent a multinational military force to Kuwait to defend that country, just as the British had done earlier. They could have issued public warnings, but they did something to the contrary. They prohibited the United States Information Agency from making a warning to Hussein on a program that had been scheduled. The Assistant Secretary of State, John Kelly, himself killed that program, and forbid any U.S. government warnings to Hussein or to the thousands of people who might become hostages in the event of an invasion of Kuwait. Then, 2 days before the invasion, the same Assistant Secretary of State, John Kelly, goes before the Congress one more time, and again he says, the United States has no commitment to defend Kuwait. Well, put all those things together, and it certainly seems to add up to a situation in which the United States was enticing or encouraging Hussein to take over Kuwait.
So here the Americans had the trap all set. They were telling the Kuwaitis not to negotiate with Iraq over the problems that they were having with Iraq. They were telling Iraq, hey, go ahead and invade Kuwait. And they were telling the Saudis that the Iraq was going to invade Saudi Arabia. So the trap was set, and old Saddam Hussein just walked right into it. So some writers, like a person for Knight Ritter, and who has who's head of the Washington Bureau of Knight Ritter, he said that it seemed to him that the U.S. had given Saddam Hussein a green light for the invasion. George Bush left the door open, and Saddam Hussein walked right through. Similar conclusion was reached by the New York Daily News. It said the State Department officials led Saddam Hussein to think that he could get away with grabbing Kuwait. The newspaper concluded that, rather cold-bloodedly, that as embarrassing as this revelation might be, well, you're going to have to examine Bush's Iraq policy with tweezers and microscopes to find out really what happened, and so the truth will come out. They said George Bush deserves plenty of credit for his impeccable handling of the Gulf crisis. He may also deserve credit for allowing the crisis to happen in the first place. And so here we are today. The United States finally got the war they wanted. They've been wanting to have a great military presence in the Middle East for many years. They've been wanting to keep down and squash any government that might become too powerful and cause a threat to Israel, or be able to attract a emergence of Arab nationalism and have one strong Arab leader emerge. And also all the other reasons we've talked about how the United States needs the war to keep the military industrial complex going and to deflect American public opinion from all the economic ills at home. So it looks like, if you believe in power politics and the old Machiavellian way of doing it, the United States just really set the whole thing up, and it worked perfectly from their point of view. You're watching Alternative Views, information which you don't get from the establishment media. Now some stories from the alternative press. The Inslaw case, which you've talked about on Alternative Views, is one of those little things, a kind of little window to the real world of espionage and murder and intelligence activities and cronyism. The establishment is trying to cover it up as fast as they can, if you read the Washington Post and the New York Times. Well, what was the Inslaw case? Well, it seems like there was a small computer company which developed some software which was able to track personnel activities and people. And the intelligence people wanted this for their operations, not only here in the United States, but also in other countries. Well, the INSLAW people had a contract with the Justice Department to develop this. And the Justice Department, the government was supposed to pay the INSLAW people, just a man and his wife were the owners, several millions of dollars. Well, it also happens that friends of attorney, former Attorney General Edmund Meese, he was Attorney General at the time, he tried to buy out INSLAW and give the goodies to a friend of his, Dr. Earl Bryan, who was part of Reagan's kitchen cabinet in California. Well, the people who owned INSLAW refused, and so the Justice Department, through various ways, forced them out of business and took the software anyway. Now, what is happening is that between 1986 and 89, nearly 30 people have either died or disappeared under mysterious circumstances, all of whom stood to reveal some crucial pieces of information on the INSLAW case in the Justice Department. There have been a lot of articles written, a lot of them in the spotlight by Harry Martin, who's the editor of the and publisher of the Napa Sentinel. Also in the Guardian, there's a good article this time. Their most immediate story that you've been reading, perhaps, if you've been following the case, is the death of Danny Casolaro. He was an investigator who was working on a book to show that the INSLAW case is just a part of an operation which he called the Octopus. It was tied to the BCCI, that notorious bank. It's tied to the October Surprise. All of these people in the intelligence community that have been doing all their nefarious activities over the past several years. Well, he wound up dead, and the authorities are claiming it was suicide, and the New York Times and Washington Post have mainly just been trying to blacken the name of Casolaro. But all of his papers were stolen, and he was also, people say he was not the type of person who would commit suicide. Well, other people have died too. There was Dennis Eisman, who was an attorney. He was going to make a trip to the West Coast to talk to a person who had information and had made an affidavit on the INSLAW case. And he had he was going to be able to back up what Casolaro was saying and what the INSLAWs were saying, and he also had some information about some of the intelligence aspects of the case. Well, Dennis Eisman was found dead. Once again, ruled suicide. Another man called Anson Eng was found dead a month before Casolaro, and he was working for the Financial Times of London, and he was in Guatemala, and he was attempting to interview a key witness in a case that was related to the INSLAW case. So there are several others of these that have, and they're continuing to go on, where people who know too much about the INSLAW case are finding they're winding up dead. This man who was supposed to get control of the INSLAW software and market it around the world, Dr. Earl Bryan, has been involved or implicated in the October Surprise in Iran-Contra, because he has had some meetings in various places around the world where he was the contact man and apparently effectuated some of the agreements. So this little INSLAW company is just a tiny little window in which we can open up and we can see the whole nefarious world of horrible things that are going on and what happens when people try to bring the truth out. They are killed.
Frank, speaking of horrible things going on, I have been reading some absolutely frightening stories in the PeaceNet database on one of the bulletin boards from the environmental climate information that indicates that the Kuwaiti oil fires may be producing one of the greatest environmental holocausts in history. There's all kinds of information that has been coming out, much of which has been covered over by the mainstream media, or at least hasn't been brought together. For instance, the Chinese claim that the Kuwaiti oil fires and the Mount Pinatubo volcano were major contributors to the disastrous rains there over the last several months. Some Chinese scientists have told the Associated Press and the United Press that based on an analysis of satellite data, information that the Chinese collected in Kuwait, and atmospheric models, they're convinced that the whole weather patterns of the entire region are being changed by the soot, by the pollution from the Kuwaiti oil fires. In fact, I've been reading reports about unusual weather all over the world. There was a heat wave this summer in Pakistan that was greater than they've ever experienced. There was record flooding in Afghanistan and Bombay, India. There was more pollution and ozone depletion than they've indicated in recent years. And experienced astronauts who have been up in the space shuttles in the last months report that the Earth is shrouded in a haze heavier than anything they've ever seen before. Shannon Lucid, who's been up on three different flights so far on the space shuttle, says, and I quote, "It looks like we're looking down through a haze. I don't know if that's because of the recent volcanic eruptions or the Kuwait fires or what. We just haven't been getting as clear a view as we had on previous missions." The haze over Africa was so thick that another astronaut noted they could barely see the ground, and the astronauts also reported that seeing the plumes of smoke over Kuwait and Iraq was very frightening because it was so black. There was just this giant pitch black cloud that was covering over the whole region. In fact, there was even a more frightening story from a military scientist, a Michael Williams, who had been involved in an advisory capacity with some of the Army people who are addressing the fire and smoke pollutions associated with the oil fires in Kuwait, and who wrote up a report drawing on, he claims, his background as a petroleum engineer in the oil industry and a former defense professional with the United States Army. And Mr. Adams says that several different conclusions have been drawn from these phenomena. One, that the smoke plume from the well fires is now the size of Iraq. On May the 1st of 1991, the Mauna Loa Observatory on the island of Hawaii measured a 20-fold increase in the amount of carbon in the atmosphere that scientists claim is carbon soot from the oil well fires in Kuwait. As of this writing, which is several weeks ago, Adams claims that the fires have generated 15 million tons of smoke and that the entire plume is hovering at an 8,000 to 12,000 feet level among the ground. If it gets up to 20,000 feet, it's even going to be more dangerous in that it will get up into the jet stream and go across the entirety of the Earth. Well, Mr. Adams said if you look at the physics of this, you will see that as this smoke cloud heats up, as the temperature rises and it gets higher, it will absorb more and more sunlight, and the temperature of the Earth will go down accordingly. This is what is called the self-lofting phenomena and the absorbing of sunlight that could cause one of the greatest agricultural failures that the human race has ever seen, that if the sunlight is blocked out effectively, if the temperatures decline, there's going to be a catastrophic effect on the world environment. And Mr. Adams says that unless immediate action is taken, unless there's a concerted effort to put out these oil well fires and to start putting tremendous amounts of water on this cloud to try to disperse it, he suggests taking the U.S. fuel tankers that were able to fuel American planes during the Gulf War and filling them with water and soaking this oil cloud to sort of wash out some of the soot and carbon. Unless there's a around-the-clock attack on the oil wells and these oil clouds, he said, this environmental disaster is likely to happen. And so far, the American government, the American media, no one is really addressing the magnitude of this threat. And Adams says it may be too late unless immediate action is taken. But of course, this would raise questions about the rationality of the Gulf War, and so these questions just aren't being raised. Clarence Thomas, the black nominee for the Supreme Court, has been connected with black fascist groups. Supreme Court Clarence Thomas is a longtime member, according to the PeaceNet Bulletin Board, of the editorial board of the Lincoln Institute's Lincoln Review. Thomas himself is a protege of J.A. Parker, who's the head of the Lincoln Institute, who was a Reagan transition team coordinator for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which Thomas was later named to direct. Well, the Lincoln Institute is being described as a black conservative group, but a more accurate description, according to the PeaceNet board, is that it's a far-right group that has worked in coalition with pro-apartheid forces and fascist anti-Semitic groups. Parker was a former registered agent for the South African government, is on the board of the National Council for National Policy, along with other pro-apartheid individuals, and at least one former member of the Indiana Ku Klux Klan. So Thomas, it appears, is connected with some very weird far-right-wing black groups.
Sunnyvale, California sounds like a nice place. Sunnyvale, all nice and warm and cozy. But Christopher McKinney, back in 1986, found out it wasn't so sunny. He was demonstrating against Ronald Reagan's Star Wars program at Lockheed Missiles and Space Company when police gave him a traffic citation for having a very threatening thing to public order. His registration sticker was upside down. So the officers questioned him, photographed him, and then arrested him for an old parking violation. Well, Mr. McKinney filed a federal civil rights suit charging infringement of his right to dissent, and all this worked its way out. So finally, what came out was that it was revealed that there is a whole complete domestic political intelligence network of the Defense Department, Defense Department organizations, and Lockheed and local police organizations, in spite of Defense Department rules. And they were spying on activist meetings in student dormitories and also in the campus ministry there. Local police departments, federal agencies, Lockheed, military, local military and leading contractor, had all formed this ad hoc espionage network where they would infiltrate, spy, and then share information. At Stanford University, there was a guy who admitted that he had done this. And the captain of the Sunnyvale police said he denied any sinister intent. He said, well, there's nothing covert about it, just a matter if they have a meeting and they're discussing their activities. We'd like to know.
And that's Alternative Views for this time. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We'd like to thank our crew for our program. Brian Lynch was a director. Kevin West and Eric Eubank also helped out. Also providing assistance were Mark Alban, Barbara Birch, Lisa Funk, Darn Harvey, Donald Herman, and Kristen Manning. Alternative Views is a presentation of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Bye.